You're listening to The Real Short Box, a comic book podcast made for geeks by geeks.
Hello, everybody. Thank you for tuning in and listening to The Real Short Box. My name is Donald, and I am here with a very special guest, one Mr. Howard Kasner. Howard, go ahead and say hello.
Well, hello.
Nice to have you on, finally, Howard.
Well, it's good to be on. Yes, it is good to be on.
Yeah, we've actually, I've been on your podcast, Pop Art, which you can find on all the major podcast platforms several times now and quite enjoyed it. So I thought it was about time we have you on ours.
Again, it's great to be here. Yeah, looking forward to it.
Yeah. One thing I wanted to mention real quick is that you do, as a primary job, is you do a lot of script coverage. So can you tell us just briefly about that and how someone could reach out to you if they wanted to get their script, some coverage on that script?
Yes, that's something I've been doing for the last 20 years, ever since I moved to Los Angeles. The easiest way to find me is probably on Facebook, either under Howard Kasner, C-A-S-N-E-R, our Howard Kasner Script Consultation. My blog is called Rantings and Ravings, and you can find me there. You could just simply email me at hkasner@aol.com.
And Howard, a little compliment your way is I listened to one of your most recent podcasts where you discussed, I believe it was a Jim Carrey film and Dark City. It was, what was that?
The Truman Show.
Truman Show. Yeah. And that was so well done. Very good stuff. It kept me entertained. And you are a great interviewer, I must say. So you did an excellent job.
Well, thank you. I'll try not to let you down.
That's great. Thanks a lot. So today we are actually going to be discussing existentialism in comic books and their films, which is something that when you mentioned that idea, I thought that was a very exciting idea. And I was like, ooh, okay. So we could talk a little bit about this. And usually, you know, when we're dealing with our podcasts and stuff, we don't get as heavy. But I thought, let's do it. Let's kind of dive right in and bring a little psychological analysis to some of these characters. I think that'd be a really cool idea. So I'm going to have you go ahead and just mention your thoughts on existentialism and how you think it pertains to comic books and their characters.
Oh, thank you. I suppose we should first start off with some idea of what existentialism is. And I will start with the caveat. I am what is called a Cracker Barrel philosopher, which means I don't have a degree in it or anything. So this is my best understanding or my own conclusions or how I see it. And existentialism was a philosophy that came about after World War II. Before that, we had modernism, where man thought that we could create a perfect world, that science had all the answers, and it was just a matter of time. And then you had World War I, World War II, the Great Depression, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, with the atomic bomb. And everybody said, no, modernism doesn't work. Man can't fix the world. And then we got existentialism. And this was a philosophy where man now had to decide, well, then what is the meaning of life? Why am I here? Why is there something instead of nothing? Is there a God? If not, what does that mean? How do I create meaning in life? And that lasted for about 25 years or so, entered French movies, then came to American film with people like Woody Allen, Martin Scorsese, Paul Schrader, and people like that. And in other ways, it also entered, I think, popular culture, maybe not so obviously. But when I was reading comic books, and these were comic books that were written in the 50s and 60s, of course, you had the Marvel Universe and you had the DC Universe. And the DC Universe never really interested me that much. The Marvel Universe was the one that interested me because the characters were very, they had problems, they had issues. Things didn't quite make sense to them. They didn't understand the world around them. What was their place in it? How do I fit in? What does it all mean? Superman, one of the themes of existentialism is when someone is put into an absurd situation. I mean, we're already in an absurd situation. We're in this world that makes no sense. So someone gets put in an absurd situation. In DC, when they did it, Superman comes to Earth, but he doesn't have much of a crisis over it. He just grows up and starts saving the world and getting rid of bad guys. Mm-hmm. But when Spider-Man becomes Spider-Man, he's suddenly, oh, am I responsible for my uncle's death? What do I do with all these powers? I can't date this woman because if someone finds out I'm a Spider-Man, you know, they might die. But I also can't date this woman because I killed her brother because I'm Spider-Man. And her brother was, I can't remember who her brother was at the time. The lizard person, I think.
Dr. Connors.
Yeah, I think maybe. He was in love with J. Jonah Jameson's secretary. And when Spider-Man was responsible for the death of her brother, she said, I would never be able to have anything to do with Spider-Man because of that. So poor Peter Parker. But it's also true for like Thor, who gets exiled to Earth and loses his memory. And he's now, instead of a god, he's this medical student and doctor who walks with a limp and is, you know.
Donald Blake, I believe, was his name.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, because he had to live his life. It was a lesson he was being shown or taught by his father that he would have to live his life as a mortal with faults, and kind of to humble him. In other words,
yes. And you have the Fantastic Four with the Thing, who now can't ever have a physical relationship. And what does that mean? And how does he live in this life? So Marvel. The Marvel Universe, the people were always undergoing existential crises. Mm-hmm. That, I think they always kept having existential crises. I stopped reading comic books when I reached seventh grade, and a lot of things changed, because when people talk about certain elements and certain plots, I go, that didn't happen when I was reading comic books.
Yeah.
Peter Parker seems to have a totally different origin story and relationships and things of that nature.
Gwen Stacy's has long since been passed, and we're dealing with Mary Jane Watson, who's the new love of his life. And through Peter Parker's storied history, love has come in and out the door, you know, quite a few times, but those are the main ones. Those are the big ones for him. When he lost Gwen Stacy, it was something that was huge in the comic book world. He tried to save her because the Green Goblin dropped her from a bridge, and he tried to save her by catching her with his webbing. But in doing that, the pressure of the fall actually snapped her neck and killed her instantly. So he actually was therefore the one that technically killed her, not the Green Goblin. And then you get into that thought process of, well, did the Green Goblin kill her, or did Spider-Man kill her? Would the fall have killed her if she'd fallen into the water, or would she have been fine? You know, in Spider-Man, in interfering, then killed her. So there became this this crisis, so to speak, within Spider-Man, of did he do the right thing? And that became very heavy, and that kind of changed the whole dynamic of the comic book in Spider-Man. It made him a much more serious character.
Well, he was always a very serious character to me when I was growing up. He sort of helped me get through elementary school and junior high, because I didn't fit in. Well, neither did Peter Parker. He had no friends. Nobody liked him. He was always a loner. And part of it was because he was incredibly smart, and part of it was because he always had to go off and stop the bad guys and save the good guys and save the victims, which always got in the way of his personal life.
Mm-hmm.
So while in the DC universe, even Batman at that time was very different than the Batman today, they were just fighting crime. But they had no existential crisis. There was no inner conflicts. They just did what they did. But in Marvel Universe, they were constantly undergoing these inner crises about what does it all mean, and why am I like this, and what do I do, and why is the world Yes, they often didn't. I can't say they ever ended that existentially, because what was wronged was made right and things were resolved. Mm-hmm. But, you know, but I saw a lot of existentialism there.
Now, do you think, real quick, when it comes to, like, for example, Batman and Captain America, both of these characters had sidekicks. Captain America had Bucky, Batman mm-hmm. had Robin, particularly Jason Todd. Now, in the comic books, the Joker bashed Jason Todd's head in, killing him. And the fans actually got to decide whether he was going to live or die. And the fans voted for him to die. And so they killed him. And the same kind of a situation with Bucky, except for there was no fan vote. It was just, should Bucky live or die? And they decided that Bucky would die while trying to help Captain America save the world. And in these instances, it created more depth to the hero because of the loss of the sidekick. Do you think that that created enough drama within those characters to make them want you to read more like you would with Spider-Man?
Well, I assume that those came, at least for Batman, came much later, right? When did that happen in Batman?
That was like in the 80s.
Right. So Batman became much darker. We saw that in the movies mm-hmm. with The Dark Knight. And I went, oh, well, this is Marvel. This isn't DC. What happened? When did Batman enter the Marvel Universe?
Yeah.
And yes, it does make him far more interesting. Captain America also goes through his own existential crisis because he disappears in the 1940s and is found much, much later. And now he's in a totally different world. And this becomes even more apparent in the movies than in the comic books, where he has to adapt and he has to find a new meaning. He's alienated. One of the major themes of existentialism is alienated, and all the heroes in Marvel were alienated, not just from the world, but from themselves. Right. In the DC comics, nobody was particularly alienated from themselves or the world.
I think they really explain it very well in, it's going to sound funny, in Mallrats. I think it was Jason Lee's character, who loves comic books. He runs into Stan Lee, and they have a conversation where Stan Lee kind of describes why he wrote these characters. And, you know, he talks about the Hulk, for example, which is a mild-mannered, you know, scientist. And then he has a rage of emotions and feelings and outbursts the next moment. Akin very much so to a what used to be a multiple personality disorder, or now a dissociative identity disorder, which is absolutely fascinating when you look at it from a psychological standpoint and not just from an avid, you know, 10-year-old comic book reader. There is a lot of depth. One thing else I wanted to ask you about that with when it came to Captain America and Batman, for example, both of those characters, Bucky came back later. And so did Jason Todd. Both of them were revealed to have been saved and not technically killed.
It's like soap operas. Nobody ever really dies.
Right. But do you think that by bringing them back, do you think that cheapens or lessens the impact of the stories that took place prior? Or do you feel that those kind of are self-contained within their own little universe as far as like a time capsule, a product of the time that it was produced, so to speak?
Well, I'm not sure I can speak too much to Batman because I haven't read that through line. Mm-hmm. But Bucky coming back in the movies, which is where I saw that, creates a whole new existential crisis for Captain America. This is mm-hmm. his friend. This is his best friend. This is his closest friend who he thought was dead. He's suddenly alive, and he's his enemy. That brings a lot of depth to it. Someone, one critic once said, and I don't know which one it was when Dr. Octopus, the movie with Spider-Man, when the villain was Dr. Octopus.
Spider-Man 2, yeah.
One of the things that differentiates Marvel comics, especially from DC comics, is that not only are the superheroes inter-conflicted and have existential problems, so do the villains. And so here we have Bucky Barnes, who now is going under an existential crisis of his own because he doesn't really remember Captain America, but he sort of does.
Yeah, there's a vague recognition there.
And it throws him into a crisis mode completely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was thinking about it in you know, you talk about existentialism. There has to be a way to put in, like, nihilism. Now, nihilism is in a way, always going to be bound or tied to that. And nihilism is basically nothingness, like nothing begets nothing. In theater, I believe it would be called Dadaism, if I'm correct. So nothing creates nothing. So as far as nihilism is concerned, would you see Deadpool as a nihilistic character?
Not really, because he doesn't act nihilistically. I find him more of an existential character. If he would have to sort of totally give up. I do get your point, though. There isn't a way. If you can never die, does life have any meaning? And why should you have any value? And what should any of it mean? It's like, to me, it's like Rick and Morty, where you just go to another parallel universe. And I'm going, well, now it is becoming completely nihilistic. I mean, nothing really has any meaning. What stops existentialism from becoming nihilistic is that once you say that life has no meaning, what does it mean to be alive? Now you have to make a decision and you have to create your own meaning. And Camus said, well, you have a choice. If you're nihilistic, you could kill yourself or you could have a cup of coffee. Mm-hmm. From an existential point of view, both are equal choices. So you might as well have the cup of coffee.
Right. Yeah.
So that's what stops existentialism from becoming nihilism. And that's sort of how I feel, too.
That reminds me a lot of the phrase of accept the full weight of your freedom in spite of the absurd.
Right.
So in spite of knowing that you could kill yourself or have a cup of coffee, you're accepting the absurdity of that situation and the fact that you would rather have that cup of coffee and continue to have that free choice rather than to accept the absurdity of the situation then I might as well just kill myself, because why do that?
Yeah.
Because you're accepting freedom then in the choice, so you realize you have that choice. So there's a lot of layers to it. It's quite fascinating. And there are, for those that don't know so much about existentialism and nihilism and things like that, there's a lot of resources online that you can look that up. There's a lot of books, definitely. There's things called libraries that still exist. I don't know if you can even go into one right now, but, you know, as far as like learning this stuff, it's out there and it's very easy. But it is fun to kind of think of these things in that way. And you often wonder if the writer had thought about these moments or these ideas when they were creating the characters, like when Jack Kirby and Stan Lee were creating these, were they layering it with this thought, or were they just that good that it automatically was part of this? It's very fascinating to think about.
Well, it's very hard to say, of course, whether they got it because that was the zeitgeist of the time, mm-hmm. and you couldn't avoid it, or whether they were watching French films, because that's where we get a lot in popular culture. We get our existentialism from the French films made in the 50s with Francois Truffaut and Jean-Luc Godard, and we also get it from Ingmar Bergman. But existentialism sort of came to an end in the late 60s and early 70s, and we got postmodernism, and today we have post-postmodernism. And ironically, though, once existentialism started leaving art cinema, it entered pop culture cinema and TV. And that's where you find it today. You won't find existentialism in Quentin Tarantino or the Coen brothers or any of the new people coming up today. They're postmodern and post-postmodern and focused on genre. But strangely enough, you have movies like Captain America Winter Soldier, where he runs into Bucky Barnes and this, and you also have it in the previous one where Captain America has a whole new morality he has to deal with. This isn't the morality of World War II. And doesn't he leave the Avengers or something of that nature because he doesn't agree with the way the Avengers is? He must make that sort of decision. And you have Endgame, where someone can get rid of is one half of the universe. If someone can get rid of one half of the universe, then what is the point of anything? And then one of the aspects of existentialism is you put someone in an absurd situation, like Alfred Hitchcock does, something that he has no control over, something that makes no sense. You put him in things like Children of Men, where suddenly people stop giving birth and there's no new people, things that you can't explain, things that make no sense. So you have this end game where someone gets rid of one third and there's nothing you can do about it. You just have to adjust.
And Thanos that's what snapped in one third of the population, or one third to one half or whatever it was, is completely gone, just eradicated from the planet Earth altogether.
And you have to adjust to that. That's what makes existential. You accept it. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't matter in existential art. It doesn't matter how absurd what happens. It's how you react to it. And that's what makes it existentialist. So you have all these people involved on all these absurd and, you know, plots that really make no logical sense, but it doesn't matter. Deadpool can't die. Well, he has to adjust to it. He has to live with it. He has to accept this absurd existence that he has. Mm-hmm. You get that then on TV with things like The Leftovers, where people disappear and they have to, you know, just deal with it. You get it in the one about the robots, Westworld, where if you can't tell the difference between a human being and a robot, is there a difference?
Right. We saw that very recently in WandaVision with, with the Scarlet Witch, Wanda Maximoff, and Vision, how she saw him not as an android, not as machine, but as human, just because of his capability to understand love. I think one of the big things that they said in there, what is pain or suffering if not the perseverance of, or is if not love persevering or the perseverance of love? And that's something that a human would recognize, not an android. So it shows his humanity and why she chose to love him and to create these children with him. So it's a very fascinating concept that they even bring over even further into the Marvel universe as far as those two characters are concerned. We saw that in Avengers Infinity War when he chose to die over everybody else dying. Him, an android, chose, knowing that he would not come back from this, that he was dead, that this is it. And the only person capable of doing that was the woman he loved, which was Wanda Maximoff. So when he, has her destroy that Infinity Stone, I think it's the Mind Stone in his head, that's it for him. That's the end of his existence. And that's some powerful stuff. That's some powerful storytelling. And that's why Marvel has succeeded so well in the cinematic universe, is because they're able to tell such powerful stories.
Well, one of the differences between the DC universe, even today in films, is their conflicts and their villains aren't particularly that interesting. And they don't have this existential worldview, except in certain, there are exceptions. And the big exception is the Dark Knight and Joker. But the Superman, the Justice League movies, I'm going, I don't care about these people. I don't care about the crises they're going through. They're they're kind of manufactured. Wonder Woman was an exception because it was just so well written. But Wonder Woman 2, they get back to these ridiculous inner conflicts of women needing men in their lives. And they had a potentially interesting existential idea with this stone that ultimately didn't quite make any sense, and they couldn't get a logical thing out of it. But the first Wonder Woman, they're fighting off some sort of demon or something.
Yeah, Ares, yeah.
Yeah, and then in the X-Men movies, you have all these people going under these existential crises because people don't want them around. They don't understand why they have these powers. Their parents don't like them having these powers. It's a parallel to being gay in some instances, and they're all going under identity crises. Logan, to me, is my personal favorite of all the movies that, though I guess it's not officially a Marvel Comics Universe film, it has those characters. If superheroes can die, what does that mean? Superman theoretically can die, but he's so impossible to kill. You never think of that. You never worry about him dying. In Logan, superheroes die.
Right.
And that's wild. You know, what do you do that? How do you live in a universe where your superheroes can die?
Mm-hmm. Suddenly the unfaulted or have faults, and you're left with the awareness that this can happen to you, just like it does everybody else.
Everybody dies. It's one of the things of existentialism. Mm-hmm. We all die. That's it. And because we die, nothing makes any sense.
Right. That's absurdity, and it's the great equalizer as well.
Yeah. And then also you have Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, where what does it mean if you have parallel universes mm-hmm. in the world? That's like my second or third favorite.
Yeah, because Spider-Man dies in his world.
Yeah.
And then suddenly there's another Spider-Man, and he's like, what is going on? You know?
And you have to live with that. You have to make peace with that. You have to make a choice. You have to accept the absurdity of everything that's going on. In Endgame, Infinity War, you have to accept the absurdity that one-third, you know, of the universe has just disappeared. Deadpool has to accept the absurdity that he can't die. And Marvel Universe is all about these people constantly having to accept all these absurd situations, an absurd world. And they have to decide, well, what are we going to do? Well, you have to accept it. And once you accept it, then you create your life within it.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense.
I take my pop culture very seriously.
Yeah. Yeah, I understand that completely. As far as film-wise, you said Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse is probably your third favorite. I think you said Logan is your favorite one.
Right.
What would be your second favorite?
It might be Thor Ragnarok, just because it's so hysterically brilliant and so new.
Yeah,
in the way it makes the universe. I also like the two. Is it Infinity War and Endgame? I like those very much. I like the new Spider-Man because that Spider-Man is closer to the Spider-Man I grew up with. Though now I'm beginning to wait for a Spider-Man where his Aunt May is actually younger than he is.
Right. Every time she gets younger and younger.
Right. The Iron Man, the first Iron Man, of course, that's what really, when I had Kevin on, mm-hmm. to talk about the Winter Soldier.
Kevin being one of the members here of the Real Short Box.
I've had all of you on now because I just recorded with Jared.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. I said that, Iron Man was the one that turned me on to the movies. And Kevin said, yeah, that's the one that pretty much turns everybody on to the movies, with Robert Downey Jr. just taking it away. So the Marvel comic universe ones, though they're not all good. I mean, we all admit that some of them work, are very much more exciting. And I always look forward to the Marvel movies. I just can't get very excited about the DC universe. It's just not very interesting.
It's not where it needs to be yet. I am a huge DC Comics fan. Always have been. I love the characterization. I love the secondary characters, the Bs and the C-level heroes, the most in DC. I feel like they're more fleshed out than some of the A-listers in DC Comics. And I feel like Marvel Comics doesn't have enough really great B and C and D-level characters that they're just not fleshed out as well as the DC ones. I feel like DC gave time to cultivate that. And that's why I appreciated DC, I think, a little more when I was younger, because I fell in love with characters like Ted Kord, the Blue Beetle, and, Booster Gold, and villains like Eclipso and Deathstroke the Terminator and things like that, because there was kind of layers to these characters and these villains that weren't necessarily in the spotlight all the time. They were backup stories or in some type of another league or team or something, you know, like the backup Justice League or whatever, the reserves or whatever you want to call them. I appreciated that. So for me, it was always kind of a DC thing, but I definitely see why so many people gravitate towards Marvel, specifically with the movies, because the movies are much more well done than the DC films. The DC films, they rushed them. Is the problem. DC's always taken their time when it's come to Superman and Batman, but not talking about Batman versus Superman, Dawn of Justice or whatever, or the Justice League. I'm talking about their individual films. You know, we're talking about the Christopher Reeve Supermans. We're talking about the Christian Bale Batmans, the Michael Keaton Batmans. They've always taken their time kind of cultivating this world around them. And they've done such a good job with that when they saw Marvel succeeding so well at these films, Warner Brothers, who owns DC, Warner Brothers said, hey, let's get our Justice League out there. And you know, I'm sure somebody in the meeting said, don't we want to build the team first and like introduce them individually in these films? And they're like, no, the Avengers already came out. We got to do the Justice League first, and then we can do the individual films. So they got the cart before the horse, you know, it just didn't work.
Well, I do think there are some DC films. I do agree with the Christopher Reeve films, though. To me, that's sort of like the Wonder Woman film, the first one, which I also like. They don't really deal with existential crisis. They don't really fit into the zeitgeist of the time. They were just so incredibly well written, incredibly well done, incredibly well acted, that I just loved them. But with The Dark Knight, with Joker, you're getting some really deep ideas and exist. I mean, Joker was a joke in the original comic books and in the Batman television show. He was entertaining, but you know, he was just the Joker. The Jokers now, both in The Dark Knight and in Joker, are very different. Mm-hmm. These are real villains. These are someone you can really aggress onto. And The Dark Knight was asking so many incredibly moral questions, like who should live and who should die, and how do you choose? It was a very powerful movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, The Dark Knight was great. Joker. You know, I can see why people would love it, and I can see why people would hate it. And, you know, in between, definitely, just because of the way it told the story of the Joker. I always see it as an reimagining, or what DC Comics would like to call an Elseworlds tale. Mm-hmm. Basically a what if, a la Marvel Comics is what they would do, which they're having coming. The What If series on, I believe it's on Disney Plus. So that'll be fascinating as well, to see all these scenarios of what if this happened or that happened and things like that. And that I always appreciate as well, is putting these characters in those situations. And Howard, honestly, I think you would probably, if you read Elseworlds stories from DC Comics, you would appreciate and enjoy a lot of them, because they do take these characters and build depth and layer them quite well in these pocket universes that they create, that these writers create for the characters that aren't canon. They're not attached to the regular stories in the comics. They're their own little tale, and they get to build and destroy and recreate as much as they want.
It sounds like it. It sounds, but as the impression I get is that, yeah, like somewhere around the 80s, things mm-hmm. changed. And they also changed for DC. They became more Marvel, from what I understand.
Yeah.
But yeah, by that time I had stopped reading comic books and had sort of left that.
Yeah, DC area got
pop culture.
DC got more heady, more intellectual with writers such as Frank Miller doing The Dark Knight Returns and Alan Moore doing The Watchmen. Things right. like that became the cornerstone of who DC Comics was in the 80s and on into, the 90s and stuff as well, to a point, until we got back into the absurd when Superman turned into lightning-based powers or electrical-based powers and became Red Superman and Blue Superman. And it got up to a point of ridiculousness, and then people kind of tuned out, and Superman then became quite unpopular again. It took a long time for him to come back.
Well, happens to all of us.
That's true. Howard, if did you have anything else to add? I think we're going to be wrapping this up in a minute.
No, I think I may have covered everything I thought I was going to cover.
You've existentialized yourself out.
I suppose so. There are probably other things, yes, we could definitely talk about, but I think I covered all the points I've been thinking about today.
I think I've been absurd enough. So with that, I think we're going to wrap that up. Howard, thank you for being on. I appreciate it very much.
Sure. I had a great time.
And once again, Howard's podcast is Pop Art. You can find that on most of the podcast platforms. And we are here. My name is Donald, and we are here, The Real Short Box. You can find us on a multitude of platforms as well. Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Spreaker, TuneIn, and all the ones in between. We do live podcasts every Monday. Usually, sometimes we take a week off, but usually we do live podcasts on our YouTube channel, which is under Rumble Spoon Productions. If you want to subscribe to us, we always appreciate that on that page on YouTube, as well as to subscribe to Pop Art and The Real Short Box on any of the podcast platforms that you listen to us on. And with that, Howard, thank you again for being on. We very much appreciate it.
Thank you very much for having me.
And if we don't see you out anytime soon, perhaps in the near future, we will see you at the comic shop.
This has been The Real Short Box. We'll see you at the comic shop. Thanks for listening.